Berg, happy because we have a fabulous show lined up for you. We're going to have three guests today, if all goes well. Our first is someone who actually participated in the COP19, the recent climate conference in Warsaw. We have talked about that the last couple of shows. But Dr. Robert Stavins is someone who actually was there. He is with the very esteemed Harvard University, the Kennedy School. In fact, I'm going to be talking about his impressions of what happened and perhaps what did not happen at that conference. And next we'll be looking at some interesting ways, kind of odd bedfellows, and that is some conservative and some progressive organizations getting together to fight, as they should, the common crisis that we all share, and that is climate change. We're going to be finding out from Darren Good, a reporter at Politico, how this is taking some interesting twists and turns. And then last but not least, we'll be speaking about the weather in Iowa. Apparently, they've got snow on the ground and frogs riveting. That's not supposed to happen at the same time. We'll be speaking to Matt Rogers about that in our second half. So without further ado, because I'm sure he's a very busy man, I want to welcome Robert Stavins to the program. He is Harvard Kennedy School's Professor of Business and Government and also the Director of Environmental Economics Department at Harvard. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You were there in Warsaw and observed, I guess, all of the proceedings, or most of them anyway. Let's start with the simple. You said the logistics were better than they've been in conferences past, and you wanted to give the Polish organizers some credit for that. In what way?
Well, I mean, the poster child of bad logistics for me for the rest of my life, not just of the annual conferences of the parties, but of any kind of conference meeting or whatever, was certainly Copenhagen in 2009, which was supposed to be, of course, a very important conference in terms of the objectives of it. That was a situation in which they, in advance, gave out 28,000 credentials via the Internet for people to participate. And the Bella Center, the venue, had a maximum capacity of 8,000. So people stood outside in the cold and the rain and the wind for many hours, never got inside. I know people that came to the airport, heard what was going on, and flew home again. Talk about a bad carbon footprint for a
meeting. Guess that is kind of an unfortunate play on words, Copenhagen. They were coping with the elements.
So that was terrible. And then, and then ironically, the two that were sort of best organized by, but when I say best organized, I mean in terms of those sorts of things, as well as a conference facility that works well, that everyone can get around to where they need to go, that's good both for the delegates, for the members of civil society, and for the press. The two that were best were probably, Poznan, which was the year before Copenhagen, and also in Poland, and then the one this year in Warsaw. Now, I'm not saying that those were the two best in terms of substance, but in terms of logistics, they certainly were.
And this particular conference started right, I believe, you know, after the Philippines typhoon, Haiyan's, the disastrous, tragic, you know, worst or most powerful storm, I think they're saying, to ever hit land. That added an extra dramatic element to it. Did you feel that?
Well, it was, yes, it was palpable, particularly because of the head of the Philippines delegation, who himself is very, very effective in any event, Yeb Sano. He stated very early on that he was going to go on a hunger strike until a meaningful agreement was reached. Fortunately for his health, his hunger strike was only during daylight hours. So otherwise, he would not still be with us, I'm afraid.
Mm. And did you hear anything from him at the end of the proceedings about his, I don't know, I doubt he was satisfied given what is at stake for his country, what's already happened. But did he make any public comment about what happened?
Well, I think he and others by the end of the sessions were essentially exhausted. You have to understand that, unfortunately, it has become the norm that although the sessions for these annual conferences are supposed to finish on Friday afternoon, it's become the norm that they go all night on Friday into Saturday morning. This time they went on until late Saturday afternoon when they finally adjourned. So the delegates have not slept in 24, 36, in some cases even 48 hours, and they're just happy to go home at that point.
Now, as someone who functions best and sometimes only on deadline pressure, a journalist for the last 25 years, and I know that things do happen at the very end, but it seems like this is becoming a kind of a standard practice at these conferences, for not much to happen, for there to be a lot of kind of dismal reports coming out of the conferences, and then the last couple of days, whether it's a U.S. delegation coming in, President Obama a couple of years ago, there's a, you know, a flurry of activity. Is that inevitable, or could that have been avoided in your
opinion? I don't think it's inevitable, but it's become the norm. Now, part of it is inevitable, I suppose, in the sense that the way the meetings are structured, they're 2 weeks long, and it's only the ministers come in only on Tuesday or Wednesday of the second week. So it's inevitable that things are, to some degree, put off until then. The idea is that all the negotiations should be concluded, that the more technical people would have worked that out at that point, and the ministers come in. And then in those situations, like in Copenhagen, where you actually have heads of state and heads of government coming in, that they would come in on Thursday and Friday, which was the case with President Obama in 2009.
Okay, well, let's get down to what was actually accomplished. You sounded like you were fairly optimistic, or at least glad that things didn't slip backwards too much.
Well, so, you know, my view of these annual conferences is that we ought not judge them the way we would judge a race of finishing and solving the problem. It's really much more like a very long marathon, or at best a very long relay race, and the big question therefore is whether or not the baton has been successfully passed. And unquestionably that was the case. There were specific objectives for this conference, and the objectives were in essence to make progress on a list of topics and a calendar from now until the conference a year from now in Lima, Peru, so that text could be agreed to in Lima that could be finalized and voted on 1 year later in Paris for what will essentially be the post-Kyoto international agreement under the Durban Platform for Enhanced Action. And that was actually accomplished. Now, someone could say that's damning with faint praise, and I'm not going to disagree with them on that, but that was the necessary objective, and it was achieved.
And would you say that the coverage of the conference, I don't know, you were there, not here, but any sense of whether the United States mainstream media, were they there? Did you feel their presence? And any idea how the coverage was, if you were able to track that when you got back, perhaps?
Oh, well, I could track it actually at both ends, because I could see the number of press who were there and who was there and who wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was definitely less than it typically is. I mean, some major news outlets were there. The New York Times had someone there who was very good. But, for example, the Washington Post did not. And every previous conference that I've been at, the Washington Post did. Many people that we talked with in advance from the press, who we'd met with in previous conferences, previous COPs, indicated that they were not be going this time. So in terms of attendance by the press, it was lower. In terms of the coverage back here, it was, you know, it's usually the case that the mainstream press will pick up on these conferences only as they're happening, or if something dramatic happens, such as in this case the walkout by, you know, international youth, essentially civil society staged a walkout one afternoon, and that got coverage. Other than that, not a tremendous amount, as far as I could tell. I was on a session that was done by PBS NewsHour, interviewed by Judy Woodruff, so I know that they covered it.
That was an excellent interview. Yes, I saw that. Well, I'm wondering if you have an opinion as to why there might have been a weaker turnout from mainstream media in this country. Do you think it's because historically there's not been much in the way of concrete results, or there's a diminishing interest, or the media planners perceive some lessened interest on the part of the American public in following climate change developments?
I think it's all of the above, combined with the fact that this was always seen as a transitional COP, that this was going to only be of, you know, procedural importance in terms of passing the baton. I think there will probably be more interest next year in the conference in Lima, Peru, just because of the fact that there's a deadline. And then I'm sure there will be more interest in the one in Paris, which is not to say it'll be successful in 2015, but I'm sure there will be more interest in that, just as there was a heightened interest in Copenhagen in 2009.
Hmm. And I noticed you wrote in your essay about the need to really build the foundation, you know, that mm-hmm. this agreement post-Kyoto, you know, really has to have momentum to go the distance. And
yeah.
Are things, in your view, proceeding, you know, so slowly that we're not going to make a difference in time? Or in your mind, does it have to go this way? I mean, we're talking about something that is daunting, complex.
I mean,
a global agreement. We, you know, can't even reach any agreements in Congress on climate change.
Right. Well, in my view, we had a false start, and we had a false start back in 1995 at the very first Conference of the Parties that was in Berlin. The very first decision at the first Conference of the Parties was the so-called Berlin Mandate, which came up with a very specific interpretation of a very important principle that is in the 1992 United Nations Convention on Global Climate Change, and that is this notion of that one should take account of the resources and the contributions of individual countries to the problems and their ability to do something about it. The phrase is common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. So that's a very important equity principle that's in the original convention. In Berlin, 2 years later in 1995, they interpreted that as a dichotomous distinction, that one set of countries, which were thought of as essentially what was then the industrialized world, should take on commitments and that all the other countries should not have any responsibility. That then became codified 2 years after that in the Kyoto Protocol, in which the Annex I countries have emissions reductions averaging 5.2% over a period of time, and other countries are not involved. That turned out to be very, very problematic path dependence, which has essentially made progress impossible. The countries that have responsibilities under the protocol, essentially the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is Europe, the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, the emissions from these countries are in every case flat or falling, and not necessarily because of policy action. They're flat or falling, and in the case of the United States, for a variety of reasons, including natural gas prices. And the emissions are growing, however, globally, dramatically growing every year, because that's because they're growing in the large emerging economies that are rapidly developing. And, of course, we applaud that development. That's China, India, Brazil, Korea, South Africa, Mexico, and Indonesia, if we include deforestation. And those countries are outside of the agreement. Furthermore, it's not even equitable, because also outside of the agreement are some very wealthy countries. In fact, on a per capita basis, the wealthiest countries in the world, the Gulf states, the Gulf oil states are not included. Singapore is not included. Israel is not included. So there's a whole set of countries that aren't in. And so the agreement can't do anything. And that's been a huge problem. Fortunately, things changed. They began to change a bit in Copenhagen and then in Cancun and then importantly in Durban, South Africa, where a new approach, a broader foundation was established, this Durban Platform for Enhanced Action, which specifies that all countries should be under essentially the same legal regime. And that's what the countries of the world are now working for Lima and for Paris, is to reach this new agreement by 2015 for implementation in 2020.
And I also found interesting in your blog post about this conference that you draw some optimism from the fact that China and U.S. are pretty much neck and neck in terms of the amount of emissions that we're spewing.
Yeah, I mean, I draw, I guess, cautious optimism or at least perhaps hopefulness. Those are the two most important countries, right? And they have been at loggerheads in the past. But starting a couple of years ago, and we saw it increasing this time, these two countries are now coming to have common interest? I mean, for one, is that if we go back, you know, to the beginning at the time of Kyoto, the U.S. was the number one emitter, and I think our emissions, if I recall, were something like four times the emissions of China. But six years ago, China surpassed the United States in annual emissions. So we're the world's two largest emitters. And then whenever anyone starts to talk about equity and what's fair, they begin, of course, to think about not just annual emissions, but cumulative emissions, contributions to the stock and the atmosphere. After all, climate change is a function of the stock and the atmosphere, not the emissions in any year. And the U.S. was number one there and still is number one in cumulative emissions, with Europe close behind. But China is going to overtake the U.S. in cumulative emissions, depending upon economic growth in the two countries, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. So it's another way in which we're beginning to have common interest in this. And then third, there's coal. I mean, coal reliance in the two countries for generating electricity is obviously very, very great. Coal reserves in the two countries are considerable, even larger in the United States as a percentage of our demand. And what's happening in the U.S., of course, is that coal demand is decreasing as a result of low natural gas prices, and that's contributed to our emissions fall. That's not happening in China, but they also, like us, have large reserves of unconventional natural gas that's accessible through fracking. But they don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the incredible network that we have in the United States of natural gas pipelines. But that's going to change, and I think that'll also bring us together. But what will particularly do it is in China, there's so much concern about coal burning, not because of climate change, but because of particulates and other localized air pollutants and human health effects. And there's huge concern about that.
Yes. So, well, they should be.
There should be. And so that's going to bring us more into alignment. And then another one, the fourth one, is that these two countries, although neither has what you might call explicit climate policies of great significance at the national level, both have subnational policies of significance. So China has these seven pilot cap and trade systems in very large cities, and they're talking about a national program in 5 years. And in the United States, we have AB 32, which is very aggressive in California.
Yep.
And the REGI program in the Northeast, which has not been binding but might become binding again. And then finally is just geopolitics, that if the 20th century, as many people would say, was the American century, it seems pretty clear that Chinese leaders think or hope that the 21st century will be the Chinese century. And that means that they do not want to be obstructionists, that they really want to be leaders. So for all those reasons, I see the beginning of a coincidence of interest between these two countries, and that could possibly lead, under the right circumstances, to some real progress taking place. So maybe that's just hopefulness, but it might also be a source of cautious optimism.
We just have time for one more question, and I have to ask you, since you are the Director of Environmental Economics Department at Harvard, you know, as Americans, we've tended to see the environment as sort of a subset of the, you know, economy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, those of us who have been tuned into our planet and nature and what's happening to it, what we're doing to it, have seen that it's so obvious that without nature and nature's, you know, resources and gifts, and without putting a price on what nature contributes to our life support system, you know, we're really missing a big connection there, that in fact, try going without your environment, that means food, water, air, just about everything. Yet we've disconnected from nature a lot in this country in particular. How do you explain to your students, you know, how without an environment that can sustain us and future generations, that there cannot be a strong, robust economy? And I guess a corollary to that question, if you can also address it in the last couple of minutes, part of the reason emissions went down in this country and perhaps worldwide was because of the recession a few years ago.
Right.
If the economy really is making, you know, a comeback and it is getting stronger and there's mixed indicators, Wall Street would make you think everything's going, you know, great guns. But, you know, if that's the case, are we going to see emissions going back up, or has that started to happen or been tracked yet?
Well, so emissions will, as a government, as a country comes out of recession and then inventories begin to get built up again. You have a lot of investment, increased industrial activity, and so there'll be greater emissions. And that's already happened in the United States because we've been coming out of the recession for quite a while now, unlike in Europe. But what's also happening is that for a variety of other reasons, including low natural gas prices, including greater energy efficiency, because energy comes at a cost. So even without policy, people and firms attempt to economize on it, we have essentially flat to declining emissions. Even coming out of the recession, that's been the case. In terms of your broader question about how I think about this with students, my view is that in a economy such as we have in the United States and in virtually all countries of the world now, market economies, the causes of environmental problems are fundamentally economic. They're externalities. They're unintentional consequences of what is otherwise meritorious activity, which is firms producing products that people want to buy and individuals using those products, whether it's my home lawnmower, my barbecue grill, or my car. So it's really economic activity that causes environmental problems. And on the flip side, as you said, it's also certainly the case that environmental problems have important economic impacts. So if the causes of environmental problems are economic and the consequences have important economic dimensions, then surely an economic lens on environmental issues is going to be very important for understanding, is going to help us to design policies that will truly be effective rather than just being symbolic and giving lip service to a problem that might be cost effective and therefore that might be more likely to be politically pragmatic. So I see economics as an essential lens onto environmental problems without which one has a very incomplete picture.
Mm. And if we had more time, I'd love to ask you about how, you know, can both our economy and our environment, you know, thrive? Can we work together, or is that too optimistic at this rather late stage in the game? But we'll have to hold that because we have two other guests waiting in the wings. But I really appreciate your taking time to join us. We've been speaking with Robert Stavins. He is the Albert Pratt Professor of Business and Government at the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University Director of the Environmental Economics Program there at that very esteemed university. Thanks for your great work, for your contributions, and we hope to have you back another time. You're a great resource.
Thanks very much, Betsy.
And we'll be back right after these messages. We're going to find out what happens when red plus blue equals green. Stay tuned. We'll talk to Politico's writer and reporter, Darren Good.